It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Sandy Rios with you on this Wednesday morning. We're going to start in an unusual way because you have an unusual opportunity to help some people this morning right away. Of course, there are needs all over the world, but we have to help where we can, right? We can't do everything, but we can do something. Steve Tiber is the founder and head of 8 Days of Hope, which is an organization that goes into places that have had a lot of problems, natural disasters and other things, and they rebuild, they take people and resources, and actually in the last, since 2005, over 35,000 8 Days of Hope volunteers have helped aid in rapid response and relief efforts on 16 rebuilding trips and 29 rapid response trips. The most current urgent situation in terms of natural disasters in Jackson, Mississippi, and I've asked Jackson, not Mississippi. Steve, help me. I'm sorry. I just went
hey,
blank.
Sandy, good morning.
No, this is Mississippi.
You?
I'm good. How are you? I got my Jackson's mixed up.
Yeah, I get it. It's early in the morning, and you're sharing a lot of great information. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. So what's happening in Jackson? I know that there's been a ton of flooding, yeah. But is there any way to quantify the damage?
Yeah, Pearl River has crested at like 36 feet, and that is the second or third highest amount ever that the part of that state in Mississippi has seen water. And so the need is great. A lot of the areas have been affected by flooding. Best estimates that we got yesterday from MEMA, which is the Mississippi Emergency Management Agency, is somewhere between 600 and 700 homes have water in them today. That number probably will go up in the next 24 hours. And unfortunately, a lot of these families have been told to stay away until the water recedes. They'll be over the next 72 hours. But our leaders and our equipment, we're heading down there this morning. God calls us to love and serve the brokenhearted, and we're passionate about that. And so our leaders will show up later today. We'll set up camp about 8 miles from where the flooding is. And then our volunteers will be starting to show up on Friday. They're going to come from around the country, and we'll be there for a full 3 weeks helping these families take the first step in a long recovery.
All right, so Stephen, practically now, bottom line, what can people do to help? What do you need?
Yeah, thank you so much. First of all, and I know it's the obvious answer, but, as a man of faith, I know that prayer works. And right now there are families who have no flood insurance and are going to be walking back to their houses or driving back to their houses over the next 72 hours, and they're going to see that 2, 3, 4 feet of water has been sitting in their house, and they're going to be devastated. So pray that the volunteers that show up are sensitive, that it isn't just about, mucking or gutting out their homes and drying it and then spraying it so mold doesn't set in. Sometimes the personal element gets lost in our urge and excitement to help somebody. So, we always tell the volunteers, right out of the gate, just love on those families. Let them know that, God has not forsaken them, that people who they don't even know are willing to drive and fly around the country to serve them. And we do it because we know who Jesus is, and we want to extend that same grace and mercy to them that they need, that we receive. So we're looking for volunteers. You need to be 18. It's free. I like free. You need to be 18. We provide the food and lodging, and you just have to get to Jackson, Mississippi. Gosh, if you fly in to Jackson, we'll even pick you up at the airport, so you don't even need transportation. All the information is on our website. I would encourage anyone wanting to volunteer, you can come for 1 day, or you can come for all 21 days that we plan to be there, because we're going to be there to March 14th. But go to our website and read the FAQs, frequently asked questions. It will tell you what to bring, where to go, what a typical day looks like, and how you can get involved. And I tell people, there is something for everyone. We need people to make food, people to drive, people to deliver tools to the families' homes that we're serving. folding T-shirts. And this is a less skilled event. When you do rapid response, Sandy, you don't have to be a skilled professional. People like me who aren't very good with their hands, you know, I can carry debris out of a house once it's been gutted because of the water. So there's something for everyone.
All right. Let me repeat. It's 8daysofhope.com for the information. And I know that many of you are always wondering. I do myself. Sometimes I just feel like I'm not doing enough for people, not enough to help. Well, this is a chance to do something that would be rewarding, personal. Of course, it'll be hard work. And some of you have lots of things that you can do. You have gifts that you don't even know you have, as Steve just talked about, things you take for granted that I have to say, as a professional woman who I actually thought I would be a homemaker and have like five kids, but my life turned out very different. So there are some tons of things that I cannot do in the home that I find my friends who've been homemaking for years are so skilled at. So there are skills that you can have that you can apply to a disaster like this. And so we are encouraging you to join Steve. AFA is a close partnership with 8 Days of Hope, and we work with them every time they have a disaster because we do trust them. So you can trust what they're doing. I think volunteers are going to start coming on Friday, right, Steve?
Yeah, so volunteers will start checking in Friday after 3 o'clock. And again, that will be the start of 22 days that volunteers can actually be serving with us. Again, it's free. Food and lodging we'll provide. I'm going to tell you right now, Sandy, I guarantee you the volunteers, when they come, they might leave tired, maybe even exhausted, but their hearts are going to be full because they're going to see Jesus in action. And I tell people all the time, the best sermon I ever heard, and I've heard some great preachers over the years, it's a sermon I saw. People need to see Jesus in action. And so, again, go to our website, 8daysofhope.com. Pray, volunteer. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And, man, you guys are amazing. You know, 80% of our volunteers come serve with us because they heard it on AFR or through AFA. So thank you so much.
That's great to hear. That's really wonderful. I love hearing that. Steve Tiber, a founder of 8 Days of Hope, and he's kind of the hub of the wheel. So, Steve, we appreciate so much all that you're doing. God bless and protect you, and I hope we'll touch base with you when this is passed and see what happened, okay?
Thank you, Sandy. I appreciate you and appreciate AFR. God bless you.
Yeah, God bless you too. All right, so we'll put 8daysofhope.com on our Facebook page so that you can find out a little more information because I'm sure you have questions, and they will be able to answer those questions. All right, back to the news. Yesterday, of course, you know that the president pardoned the former governor of Illinois. Now, you know this is personal to me because I'm from Illinois. Rob Blagojevich is the 10th governor of Illinois who's been sentenced to prison for corruption. It happened, back in 2010, I think it was. Rob Blagojevich, a very colorful character, big mop of hair, just a very larger than life, maybe not in a good way. And he was sent to prison for 14 years for trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat and also trying to extort a children's hospital. They had him on tape doing some things like that. So the president was asked yesterday about his pardon of Rod Blagojevich, and this is what he had to say.
Yes, we have commuted the sentence of Rod Blagojevich. He served 8 years in jail. It's a long time, and I watched his wife on television. I don't know him very well. I met him a couple of times. He was on for a short while of The Apprentice years ago. Seemed like a very nice person. Don't know him. But he served 8 years in jail. There's a long time to go. Many people disagree with the sentence. He's a Democrat. He's not a Republican. It was a prosecution by the same people, Comey, Fitzpatrick, the same group, very far from his children. They're growing older. They're going to high school now. They rarely get to see their father outside of an orange uniform. I saw that, and I did commute his sentence. So he'll be able to go back home with his family after serving 8 years in jail. That was a tremendously powerful, ridiculous sentence, in my opinion.
Well, let me just tell you a few things about this that you won't probably see. The president alluded to it, but there was a lot going on in Chicago at that time. Barack Obama had just been elected, 2008? This is 2010. And the allegation, of course, is that Blagojevich tried to sell his Senate seat. But from all accounts during that time, and I'm not going to declare anything, I'm just telling you what the rumblings were, that there might have been some involvement of Barack Obama in this. I could just tell you he was interviewed by the FBI during that time, and it was secret and private, and no one knew about that. But Blagojevich took the hit for this, and I'm not saying he's an innocent person. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there was a lot of stuff going on that was really very suspicious. And President Trump just alluded to the fact that it was, you wouldn't probably know that Patrick Fitzgerald was the U.S. attorney in Illinois at the time, and he was very close to James Comey. And they were very close to Bob Mueller. Bob Mueller was the FBI director then. James Comey was part of the Justice Department in some capacity, the leadership. He's the one that appointed Patrick Fitzgerald, and Patrick is the one that went after Blagojevich. Patrick Fitzgerald also went after Scooter Libby. Remember that horrendous prosecution? And these guys also went after the president's personal attorney in New York, whose name escapes me in this very moment. Remember they got into his files, and they appointed a Soros-affiliated attorney to have access to all of the attorney files that he had in his office. Just a lot of really, I'm not talking about Blagojevich, I'm talking about the president's private attorney, Cohen, in New York. But these same characters involved. And now Blagojevich was a Democrat, but one always has to wonder what that was all about. Some of us felt that Blagojevich might have known something about Barack Obama that they didn't want him to talk about. We don't know that, but we'll find out. He's going to do a press conference. Well, we may or may not find out. He's going to do a press conference this morning. It'll be interesting. And again, I'm not saying he's an innocent figure. I'm not saying that because he was just, he was a strange person. But I won't go any further into that. Let me just say that that's what happened yesterday, and there were other pardons, as you probably well know, but I don't have really time to talk about the others. I want to talk about the debate tonight in Nevada. There are going to be six contenders on the stage. At this point, Bernie Sanders is ahead by 27%. Joe Biden is in second place with 15%, but he's only 1% ahead of Michael Bloomberg, who is only 1% ahead of Pete Buttigieg at 13%. And then you have, Bloomberg and Warren are tied at 14%, so I left her out, sorry. And the person last man standing is a woman. It's Amy Klobuchar. She's in somewhere around 7%. So that's what's happening tonight in Nevada. And interesting little sidebars on that. Bernie Sanders is running into trouble with the unions there, especially the culinary union, because you probably know that unions have been able to negotiate really great health care packages in the last 20-plus years, like Cadillac plans, they call them. So Bernie Sanders is talking about doing away with private health insurance. You know that? So the Culinary Union, among others in Las Vegas, is really up in arms, and they are against him. They've been kind of protesting some of his rallies. And so as reported in the Washington Examiner, at a December speech in Las Vegas, Sanders was shouted down by union protesters when he tried to make the pitch for his socialized health insurance program. When they did that, they were attacked by the Sanders bros, you know, the Bernie's bros, which that's a vernacular I just learned. It's about the thugs that surround him. Like maybe they're talking about the organizers in his state offices in Iowa and South Carolina and others, Antifa. Yeah, those are Bernie's, you know, bros. And so they came after the union, and the union was very upset. They said that they viciously attacked the culinary union and working families in Nevada. So this is going to be interesting tonight. That's a little sidebar you might not know about. I didn't know about that. So also, Michael Bloomberg continues to be in the crossfire. It'll be his first time on the stage. The most damning thing was a woman named Lita Hong Fincher has come out and written a whole piece about how she wrote a piece for Bloomberg about it was critical of Chinese Communist Party leaders and how Bloomberg and the organization shut her down and threatened her. And then the allegation is that Bloomberg is so closely tied to China and his operations are so dependent on their relationships with China that they came after her with a vengeance. It's quite a long story. And that's isn't that interesting? If that's true, which it seems like it might be true, you can see why Bloomberg would want to challenge Donald Trump on the issue of China alone. All right, well, tonight Las Vegas is going to be the debate. We'll talk about it tomorrow. But boy, coming up next, something really fascinating, another story that you probably haven't heard, so please stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Here is some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare. It's the affordable alternative to health insurance. And it's worked beautifully for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country. MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing ministry. And over the years, members have shared over $3 billion of each other's medical bills. So they could help share your needs too. And best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is about $500 a month. Your savings could be more or less, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. You're not stuck with a high-cost health plan. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. Here's the number to find out more, and there's no pressure. They are super easy to talk to. Call 833-44-BIBLE. That's 833-44-BIBLE, 833-44-BIBLE.
This is Pause to Pray, a chance to stop down from the daily noise of life and pray for our country's leaders.
Today we pray for Christopher Tuttle, Chief Financial Officer of the Federal Financing Bank. His office helps reduce the federal cost of borrowing, as well as federally assisted borrowing from the public. Corinthians 4:2 reminds us of the quality needed to be a good steward of money. Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. Right now, with this in mind, let's pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, we ask for guidance for Christopher Tuttle as he helps manage our country's financial obligations. It's an important job, and we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Pause to Pray is a service of this station and the Presidential Prayer Team, a nonprofit, nonpartisan ministry dedicated to encouraging prayer for our nation's leaders. To learn more, go to pausetopray.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
My name is Dr. Andrew Favich, and I teach microbiology here at Drew McConnell University. And so instead of trying to teach biology from this perspective that gives you this goo-to-you version of evolution, you get this perspective of this is who God is, this is who God has revealed himself to be, and he's revealed himself in nature, which is terribly exciting to study.
Hi, Todd Starnes here. Truett offers biblically-centered degree programs. Check out truett.edu/starnes. Republicans and Democrats are fired up after Mayor Michael Bloomberg insulted American farmers and blue-collar workers. Back in 2016, Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, was on a panel at the University of Oxford. He was asked a question about whether it's possible to unite people in Middle America with the coastal elites. Bloomberg says the problem is the inability of blue-collar workers to adapt to the information age. As for farmers, he said, in essence, you don't need a lot of gray matter in your brain to plant corn. Clearly, Mr. Bloomberg has mastered the art of arrogance. This is a man who wants to be president of the United States, and I doubt he knows the difference between a soybean and a butter bean. In the words of former President Dwight Eisenhower, a son of Kansas, farming looks mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles from the cornfield. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Ranking member, it's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you testified in the deposition that you did not know who the whistleblower was or is.
I do not know who the whistleblower is. That is.
Well, how is it possible for you to name these people and then out the whistleblower?
Per the advice of my counsel, I've been advised not to answer specific questions about members of the intelligence community.
Are you aware that this is the intelligence committee that's conducting an impeachment hearing?
Of course I am.
Wouldn't the appropriate place for you to come to testify would be the intelligence committee about someone within the intelligence community?
Ranking member, per the advice of my counsel and the instructions from the chairman, I've been advised not to provide any specifics on who I have spoken to with inside the intelligence community. What I can offer is that these were properly cleared individuals, or was a properly cleared individual with a need to know.
All right, that was the voice that might be familiar. At least the circumstances should be close enough at hand that you should remember that that was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified before the House Intelligence Committee about his knowledge of the phone call that President Trump made to the president of Ukraine. And then, of course, I think, again, I have trouble because the news is so thick, I can't remember which day. But it was just recently that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was marched out of the White House along with his twin brother. They both served on the National Security Council. And Vindman, of course, testified in uniform and said a lot of things. And I think the next person that we're going to introduce here might have some thoughts about this. He is a friend. You've heard him on this show with me before. His name is Rich Higgins. He's a senior fellow of Unconstrained Analytics. He's a counterterrorism expert. He himself served on the National Security Council under President Trump's National Security Council in 2017. And he himself was also marched out of the building under very different circumstances. Rich, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, Sandy, it's great to be back.
You know what? Let's set the stage for this because in the early, well, immediately when President Trump was elected, the Security Council was led by Michael Flynn, right?
Correct.
And you had been campaigning for the president because you liked his foreign policy, as I understand it.
Yes, I had started supporting him back in 2015.
And you thought that you were going to get a position on the National Security Council. Tell us about that.
Well, I ended up being offered initially a position to work the counterterrorism portfolio as a senior director, and then I ended up being pushed back by some of the resistance elements inside, both establishment Republican and Obama holdovers. So I ended up, after some debate, taking a more junior position because I ended up actually getting onto the Security Council the last week of February, maybe the first week of March of 2017. And I went in there knowing, it was a bureaucratic battle zone. And I wanted to see, how bad is it? What can I do to help? And it was far worse than I expected. I mean, what we now know is, a soft coup or a white coup is the technical term, was going on all around us. So after about, maybe 8-10 weeks, I wrote a memo with a couple of other folks, knowing that the National Security Council itself was compromised, I couldn't use the chain of command, and so I reached out to some of the people that I had served with during the actual campaign and wrote a memo to them, basically warning them, the now infamous POTUS and political warfare memo that was seeking to, let the president know, who was new to politics, that what he was experiencing was way outside the bounds of anything that, you'd see in a normal transition of power. When the president read it, allegedly, he never told me he read it, but I heard from people in the National Security Council who I maintained contact with, when the president read it, he liked it and had instructed McMaster to basically act upon it. And his idea of acting upon it was to, my feet didn't hit the ground. I basically, was thrown out of the National Security Council and out onto the street. And shortly after that, a couple of the guys who had been working with me to stop the coup, Derek Harvey and Ezra Cohen, were thrown out literally the following week. So I have some experience with the departure process.
Yes, you do. And I want to talk about that. But let's go back for a second. Because some of this stuff, we can't take for granted that people kind of are comprehending. When you say there was a coup or a counter move at the NSC, I think I would say that H.R. McMaster was part of that. And he was appointed after Lieutenant General Flynn was removed for all the reasons that we know and are still learning. So H.R. McMaster, is that true? Would you affirm that from your vantage point, H.R. McMaster was countermanding the president's wishes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you look at the removal of Flynn. I mean, I know you're married to a former FBI agent. What would drive the FBI to doctor a 302, to have a lawyer, Lisa Page, review that 302 to ensure it met the legal standard for being a violation of the law, so that they could use that to remove Flynn, which they did. They also needed to remove Sessions. Now, there's a lot out there about Flynn being removed because he was going to audit the intelligence community or something like that. I think that's just nonsense. It was a tactical decision as part of an operation that drove them to do that. They knew they needed to get the Attorney General out of there and the National Security Advisor out of there because they were two people in the chain of command that would have had oversight of the FISA and the surveillance. So those guys needed to be removed so that they could maintain spying on the president.
All right, so you've got two things, at least two things going on. You've got spying on the president, which pretty much, you don't have to convince people of that now. By the way, I just talked to Cheryl Atkinson yesterday, speaking of being spied on, and they were employing the same tactics on her that they did on the president, but that's another story. So you have this spying on him, but you also have an undermining of his policies. And so describe that, Rich. What are we talking about?
I think, you know, the simplest way to describe it is the communications flow is inverted. You basically had the institutions telling the president what he could do. And General McMaster saw his job as taking from the institutions and then giving to the president what he was allowed to do, you know, the guardrails, if you will. Whereas, you know, in a normal relationship with your security advisor, you as the president are going to issue your commander's intent, and the national security advisor is then going to work with his staff to help drive that policy down into the interagency staff and the, you know, the various cabinet level departments, so as to be able to fulfill those objectives, which were, you know, which were the objectives voted upon by the American people. We didn't see that. Things like withdrawal from Afghanistan weren't really even seriously considered. And so, you know, there was a, you know, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, there were less than 10 people on the National Security Council that supported President Trump's agenda. And everybody else was either a partisan leftist remnant from the Obama administration, or, normal people just kind of watching the political fray go on around them, who tended to default to their institutional guidance. So we were fighting an uphill battle. You know, I famously described it to Bannon and Flynn during the period right after the election win that we were going into Omaha Beach, and they didn't believe me. You know, and but I had served in both the Bush and Obama administrations. I knew how calcified the bureaucracy had become and what we were actually up against.
So there were lots of warnings to the president about McMaster. There were lots of people trying to get the word to him that he was being undermined in many, many, many ways. And the National Security Council was probably one of the worst examples or most egregious examples. And yet McMaster stayed for a long time, but finally he was removed. I know the president, as far as I know, Rich, the president actually did read your memo, but this stuff kept happening. And so do you feel, I want to talk, I'm not through talking about this, but this is a question that occurs to me. Do you feel that the National Security Council has been reconfigured enough to actually do what the president wants it to do now, or to give him good advice, trustworthy advice?
I think Robert O'Brien has made a lot of, really, you know, net positive steps. I'm still concerned about, you know, about what's going on there. I still think it's too big. I mean, you know, John F. Kennedy went through the Cuban Missile Crisis with a National Security Council of 12 people. You know, it's just become this bloated bureaucratic thing that exists only under the executive office of the president. I mean, if the president wanted to, he could dissolve the National Security Council today with a memo. There's no legislative or statutory requirement to even keep it. So if it's not serving his interests, you know, that may be the next step down the road. I think we all owe, you know, Robert O'Brien a chance to see if he can bring it in line. You know, certainly removing 70 people, you know, getting rid of the Venmans, apparently they've ferreted out now anonymous. That's all good news and steps in the right direction, but it remains to be seen.
I'm curious, did you serve with the Venman brothers, or did they come later?
They came after me. They came in 2018. I think it's very odd that two brothers, both of Russian ethnic backgrounds, showed up there at the same time. I mean, their other brother was married in Moscow. Just a lot of weird stuff that's around them. I was talking to a security officer I know, and he had been stationed in Eastern Europe and knew of Alexander Vindman because he was a walking security violation. I'm told that he had 15 security violations in his 2 years when he was in Moscow. Now, if that's true, that's actually surreal, because, you know, the normal State Department policy is three security violations and you're out. So there's a lot of weird stuff going with Mr. Vindman, and, you know, that remains unexplained to this point.
Boy, it surely does. And was it McMaster? I don't know if you know this. I'm just curious if you do know who appointed him, the Vindmans. Was it McMaster?
I don't know. I mean, I think McMaster was still there at the time. He came in around about the same time that Bolton came in. I'm just not sure, Sandy.
Yeah. All right. So now just a practical question. As Vindman was testifying, and I'm sure you're watching it in some form or fashion, Rich, he's sitting there in his uniform, and he's talking about a presidential phone call, which is top secret, that he was assigned and tasked to listen to between another world leader. And he wrote some memo about it. As though it was the worst thing he'd ever heard. It was horrible. He was frightened. He was concerned. These are my words. I can't remember his words. He was, in a turmoil. It was such a traumatic thing. And he rushed right to the whistleblower, who we believe is Eric Chiaramella. He did not go to his supervisors, as far as I know. Did you track all of that so that you could correct me or add to that conversation?
Right. I mean, Sandy, I'll simplify it for your listeners. It was an operation conducted against the president. Yeah, there were suspicions because this was, remember, the July phone call, the July 2019 phone call, was 3 months after the initial phone call with Zelensky when he won the election. And shortly after that first phone call with Zelensky, media leaks started coming about, Trump was making deals with Zelensky and so on and so forth. But the roots of those stories never got, they never actually got any traction. So then 3 months later, when this next phone call takes place, all of a sudden, there is now a whistleblower, the intelligence community, IG doctors, the form. You have Adam Schiff jumping on board, running this, just shredding the Constitution in front of all of our eyes with the secret testimony and secret witnesses. And it was just unbelievable. I mean, they were doing to the Constitution and due process what Nancy Pelosi did to the State of the Union speech. I mean, they were literally just shredding it in front of our eyes. I couldn't believe watching it happen. But the point being, it was an operation from the very beginning by the same people who had conducted the coup initially, primarily from the Department of Justice's National Security Division, and Mary McCord and Michael Atkinson and Chiaramella, all of whom were involved in the first phase of the coup, now found themselves involved in this part of the coup. Chiaramella is the Forrest Gump of all these events. I can't believe the way that the Republicans are playing this, to be honest with you. Eric Chiaramella was involved in the Ukraine. He was the National Security Council lead on the Biden thing. He was involved in the spying on the campaigns. He was suspect in leaking the presidential telephone transcripts. He was brought into the front office. He's cited in the Mueller report as being the source of the Putin directed the firing of Comey narrative in an email he sent to John Kelly in May of 2017. After he finally departs the National Security Council, because the Mueller special counsel had been stood up, my belief, he thought he had done his job and Trump would be removed. When Mueller failed, they had to go to option B, option B being let's try and impeach him. If you look at it from sort of a tradecraft operational perspective, it's very clear what's going on here. And unfortunately, to date, we just haven't seen the counterintelligence, counteroperational type response that's necessary.
Well, you just said something that really caught my ear because it's something I wanted to talk to you about. You say Chiaramella was briefing John Kelly, which morphs into this John Kelly finally letting loose on President Trump after having, held his confidence. He was chief of staff. And he says Vindman was blameless and simply following the training he'd received. So now Vindman's connected to Eric Chiaramella. Now you say John Kelly was getting briefed by Eric Chiaramella. I'd like your comments about John Kelly's speech, his public statements now, and his potential involvement in this. Plus, Rich, I want to morph into something that's you've spent so much time tonight is a debate in Las Vegas among the Democratic candidates. And you were the one tracking that horrible, brutal killing of 58 people at a concert and injury of several hundred others. And I want to talk a little bit about what you think happened there, if you don't mind. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. A convicted sex offender protested to the court that he had always been an 8-year-old girl. Joseph Gobrick, 45 years old, was convicted in 2001 and served 8 years in prison for sexual abuse. He was rearrested in 2018 after a 17-year-old missing Ohio girl was found in his Grand Rapids, Michigan home. Gobrick was also found with child pornography on his computer, including images of infants to 5-year-olds. He claimed to be an 8-year-old girl as a defense against the new charges. This is where delusion takes us.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Hi, this is Dan Celia from Financial Issues. We as God's people need to be good stewards of all that He has given us. That is so important, and that's what drives me each day as I break down the latest financial numbers and talk to listeners across the country about their use of the money that God has entrusted to them. Join me each morning from 8 to 10 Central and Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock Central Time for Financial Issues right here on American Family Radio.
American Family Radio newscasts are now available as a podcast.
I'm Rusty Pugh.
I'm Steve Jordahl.
Didn't catch the full story? Listen to the podcast.
I'm Chris Woodward.
I'm Chad Groening.
Didn't have the radio on at the top of the hour? Listen to the podcast.
I'm Charlie Bunch.
And I'm Fred Jackson.
Get accurate news from a Christian perspective whenever you want it with the American Family News podcast. You can also sign up for our daily news brief. Visit onenewsnow.com.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. The Bible says God made mankind male and female, two but only two sexes, nothing in between, nothing on either side. And science agrees. Two prominent biologists from Penn State and the University of Manchester in England write in the Wall Street Journal, quote, "Biologists and medical professionals need to stand up for the empirical reality of biological sex because the denial of biological sex is at odds with the scientific understanding of human sexuality. No third type of sex cells exists in humans, they say, and therefore there is no sex spectrum or additional sexes beyond male and female. Sex is binary," end quote. Says another biologist, "A male on the day of his conception will remain a male on the day of his death. The Bible told us that 3,500 years ago. Ladies and gentlemen, do not doubt this book."
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last Thursday, the Justice Department brought the hammer down on the Chinese Communist Party's prime instrument for its digital imperialism, the telecommunications conglomerate Huawei. The company and four of its subsidiaries were charged with such crimes as racketeering, the theft of intellectual property, and violating U.S. sanctions on Iran and North Korea. The indictment paints a familiar picture of aggressive, illegal Chinese activity, accompanied by fraudulent business dealings, cynical lies, and shameless deception. Also charged with criminal conduct was the daughter of Huawei's founder, who were trying to extradite from Canada. These welcome actions by one Trump administration agency against the enabler of Communist China's 5G wireless hegemonism makes all the more ill-advised a recent decision by the Commerce Department to allow the company to have continued access to U.S. technology. Repeat after me. No way, Huawei. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. Rich Higgins is my guest. He's a senior fellow for Unconstrained Analytics. He's a counterterrorism expert. It's always fascinating to talk to Rich. And by the way, I did not say he has told his story in the Wall Street Journal. It's titled, "The White House Fired Me for My Loyalty." And we'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can refer to it and tell your friends what we're talking about today. Rich, before we go to the debates in Las Vegas and just Las Vegas and your background in investigating what happened there, I want to talk about John Kelly just for a second more. He's the chief of staff. He's a former Marine general. And now he's, talking. Yeah, like talking. In fact, he said in this speech, it was a 75-minute speech, he said that Vindman is blameless and was simply following the training he'd received as a soldier. He said that he did exactly what we teach them to do from cradle to grave. He went and told his boss what he heard. He talks about when Vindman heard the president tell Zelensky he wanted to see the Biden family investigated, that was tantamount to hearing an illegal order, Kelly said. We teach them, don't follow an illegal order, and if you're ever given one, you'll raise it to whoever gives it to you that this is an illegal order, and then tell your boss. I just love to know your thoughts about Kelly speaking out like that and those statements.
All respect to General Kelly. You know, he lost his son in Afghanistan. I'm not gonna question his patriotism, but I have to question his politics here. I mean, anytime somebody uses words like blameless, in absolutes like that, I immediately begin to question their motives. He's stating some untruths there. Number one, he did not tell his boss or use the chain of command. That was one of the major issues that his direct supervisor complained about under oath. We have all seen the transcript. Even if it was alluded to that the president did hope to have an investigation opened on Biden, perhaps it was because he knew how corrupt Biden actually was. And the irony is not lost on me that, Joe Biden is now carrying the corrupt bag for the Democrats, and Hillary Clinton, the El Chapo of corruption, it continues to just skate on by. I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes here. I think General Kelly has to elaborate a little bit more fully on specifically in Section 2 of the Mueller report, footnote 468, which shows that Eric Chiarmella was communicating with General Kelly when he was the Secretary of Homeland Security about meetings in the Oval Office. That is highly unusual and certainly outside the chain of command. And it appears to be, at least from the footnote, where the Putin directed the firing of Comey narrative was originally born. And we saw what that put the country through. I think there are a lot of people who have sort of these glass houses and these icons of, generals and these institutions like the FBI. And we just have to, take at face value that we have been collectively betrayed. And, salvaging the institutions, maybe not salvaging the institutions, we have to be open-minded about the solution or the solutions to, problems of this magnitude.
Yes, and that's why I think at least there's some encouragement in the president beginning to clean house a bit. And finally, honestly, Rich, I think you would agree to have him finally listening to people that are actually his friends, about the people around him who are not serving him well. It's taken a long time to get that message to the president. He's been actually very forgiving, too forgiving, and a lot of damage has been done. So anyway, transfer the conversation just for a second. I think it's ironic that that you're my guest today and that the debate tonight for the Democrats is taking place in Las Vegas. And Las Vegas, of course, conjures up a horrible event that happened there in October of 2017 when a shooter known as Stephen Paddock, rented a room in a high-rise hotel and opened fire and murdered 58 people what's called the Route 91 Country Music Festival. And Rich, as a result of that, I'll just say what public people know. I would say this. We know that most of the people there, it was a country western concert, were conservatives, probably politically. And we also know that Stephen Paddock, suddenly the investigation went silent. It went silent for weeks and months, maybe even a year. They kept telling us they didn't know hardly anything, and they would eke out bits of information. You, as a counterterrorism expert, and others have worked really hard to try to figure out what actually happened there, since the FBI doesn't seem to be willing to tell us. And if I'm wrong about that, if the FBI has come in with a logical explanation and I missed it, please correct me. But then if I'm not wrong, then tell us what kind of, in a synopsis, what you found and what you think might have transpired.
Well, I think the most important thing for your listeners to know is that there are still good guys in the FBI, and they're repressed, and they're certainly not selected for promotion past the GS 14, 15 level. In a nutshell, I don't know if you recall Senator Johnson up on the Senate Homeland Security Committee talking about the FBI having a quote-unquote secret society inside of it. And while that may be a poor word choice, he was right. I mean, it was a small secret group that was meeting off-site or coordinating over Skype that was participant in A, trying to stop Trump, and B, trying to remove him after he'd been elected to office. And a lot of the names in that group are, you know, names people know, the lawyer, Jim Baker, McCabe, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok. But one of the names on that group was a guy named Aaron Rouse. And what's interesting about Aaron Rouse is he had worked in counterintelligence with Peter Strzok and Andy McCabe, but he was the special agent in charge of the Las Vegas office of the FBI when the attack happened. The most interesting thing about the attack itself is that, you know, the FBI basically said this isn't terrorism, and they left it to the Las Vegas police to kind of deal with what they found. The dead guy in the room, the 58 people laying dead on the field. Kind of case closed. Despite the fact that ISIS had issued in the summer prior to the attack two warnings that they were going to attack Las Vegas, and despite the fact that after the attack, ISIS claimed it four times. And, oddly, the Antifa group out of Melbourne, Australia, also claimed the attack. Doing some basic research with other guys I know across the counterterrorism community, we just started monitoring open source information, and we found some very, suspicious individuals who had been in Las Vegas at the time of the attack, and some of them had conducted interviews on television in Australia, closely affiliated with leftist causes, and never were even interviewed by the FBI, despite public statements claiming they were on the 32nd floor at the time of the attack, had snuck out through a kitchen, hid for 3.5 hours, but then disappeared for 5 days on social media. And these are individuals that are, currently loose inside the United States and still have not been interviewed by the FBI. It's really a remarkable sequence of events. There was some debate as to, he just won an attack and it's really about the weapons. In counterterrorism, one of the absolute truths, and I've done counterterrorism for almost 30 years, Sandy. It's kind of like the cops. In the target is the motive. And it was military and police appreciation night at the end of a 3 or 4 day country music festival in the town of Trump's largest donors, Sheldon Adelson and Steve Wynn, who'd been the RNC finance guy. If it walks like a duck, it's quite clear to me what that was.
Well, I just wanted to point, this is from a layman's perspective, Steve, because you know so much. Rich, I was just reading Stephen Paddock's name. Rich, you know so much that sometimes maybe it's hard to step back, but from an obvious perspective, just the silence, the quick declaration that it was not terrorism was such a red flag to me. And then the silence over Stephen Paddock, the mystery, the inability to find out very much about him, how things were just shut down. There were just some blatant holes.
Well, two other data points for your listeners. One is that the FBI, normally a field office would control an investigation like that, and if additional resources were required, for example, it had been an ISIS attack, headquarters in Washington would surge additional resources into the area. You didn't see that happen in this case, except for the forensic evidence recovery team. The other thing that's interesting is the immediate actions after the attack were to have operational control of the response brought up to the 7th floor at the Hoover Building in Washington, D.C., which is highly unusual. And you find yourself asking, what is going on here? Again, the absolute silence from Congress, the absolute silence and oversight. And then 2 or 3 weeks ago, I saw it was picked up by, I believe, the New York Post. Stephen Paddock's girlfriend, the one who he'd given money and sent off to the Philippines or whatnot. Now, recall, she's also Australian. She was arrested in New Zealand carrying a fake weapon. And it just blurped up on the radar screen quickly and then went back underground. But it's very important to note that the Australian Antifa connection to the Vegas attack, And one of the principal suspects that you know, I would say is certainly a person of interest, if not an outright suspect, is from Melbourne, Australia. Arlu Danley is from Australia. There's just a lot of loose ends that haven't been investigated. I'm not saying I know what happened. I'm saying nobody knows what happened.
Because why don't we know? And I'm asking, why don't we know? You know, why don't we know? Why didn't they get to the bottom? That was a horrific killing, a slaughter. And why weren't the powers that be more concerned? And you know, Rich, I think the other incriminating thing is that somewhere around that time, and I'm sorry I don't have the date in front of me, there was that attempted mass shooting in Alexandria, Virginia, of the Republican congressman. Steve Scalise was nearly mortally wounded. Everyone will remember that, I hope, although it didn't really get all that much press. The FBI did a press conference after that, after they'd come to their conclusion. And I watched that live, Rich. I'll never forget it. And the agent in charge was so very smug and assured us that, you know, maybe there was some problems at home with the shooter. We can't possibly know motive. And he was very arrogant and very dismissive. And many of us just knew. I mean, the guy was a Bernie supporter. And I think there was evidence that there was some political motive. It was a Republican event, after all. And he'd ask, you know, one of the Republican congressmen in the parking lot, are these Republicans? And yet nothing was made of that. So there was this climate of distrust, I'll say, for me toward the FBI, was the way the FBI was handling a lot of things, not the least of which was the president's matters and affairs. So I think that's another contributing fact. Well, are you still working on this? You have done a long paper. By the way, can we post that on our Facebook page? Your treatise on what might have happened there?
Let me make sure. Yeah, I just want to make sure there's nothing personal information or anything in there. I don't want to give phone numbers and stuff with people, but sure.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, we'll wait till you check that out. But it's fascinating, and some of you have had your curiosity aroused and you really want to know more about what Rich has to say about that, it is a fascinating read. So, Rich, are you feeling optimistic at this time about the way the country's going, or where are the danger points now from your perspective?
I have to be honest with you. I think President Trump is doing a fantastic job. He is rightly recognizing that the Democrat Party has fully embraced Marxist-Leninism. You have Bernie Sanders, an open Trotskyite, leading the ticket. You have Pete Buttigieg, who is a Gramsci Marxist, whose father was the head of the International Gramsci Society. You have Bloomberg, who is basically a Chinese agent for all intents and purposes, and that's their party today. They are the Communist Party of the United States. Donald Trump recognizes that, and he's creating the big tent, and you see rallies where, you know, 175,000 people are trying to come to political rallies. It tells me that the MAGA movement is transcendent, and it's bigger than Trump. So I think he's done a very good job of helping build back America's sense of itself. I'm concerned by how the state, and the people that are aligned with the coup, and just the hate America crowd is going to react. I anticipate more violence.
Yeah.
I anticipate traps. And I think the president has done that. I don't know what happened in the past month or two with the president, maybe the impeachment ending, but even before that, he is on message, not just from a political standpoint. He's on message and he's making these personnel decisions that, candidly, we've been waiting for 2 or 3 years.
I know, Rich, I have to interrupt you. I have to interrupt you because we're ending. But interesting, a great ending, encouraging. And thank you, Rich, for all that you've done to serve this country. Rich Higgins, Senior Fellow, Unconstrained Analytics. Sandy Rios in the Morning, AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio. Faith.